This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
Support for The Exchange weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. With police use of force on the national agenda, a New Hampshire state trooper has been relieved of duty after a controversial video surfaced this week showing officers beating a man after a two-state car chase that ended in Nashua. Senior Assistant Attorney General Jeffrey Stelzen said his office will be looking into the incident.
Our office is going to be conducting a criminal investigation to determine what force was used last night in Nashua, by whom, and whether it was appropriate under the law.
Meanwhile, more than 800 people packed into a Manchester hotel room for the governor's summit on substance abuse on Tuesday. U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack attended, representing a White House initiative on rural opioid abuse. Speaking on NHPR's Morning Edition, Secretary Vilsack praised efforts by the drug court in Hillsborough County.
Well, what a tremendous work they're doing in terms of providing the opportunity for the people that are highest at risk of taking drugs again, highest risk of going back to jail. Recognizing that we can't incarcerate our way out of this problem, we have to treat our way out of the problem.
And finally, it's spring in New Hampshire, where if you sit by a flowering azalea or lilac, you might hear the sound of buzzing bees. Still, scientists are concerned about bee colony collapse. UNH Assistant Professor of Biology Susan Rehan has taken a census of New Hampshire's bees.
We're kind of assessing situations perhaps after the damage is done, but the best thing we can do moving forward is really to establish what we have and how they are doing and try to preserve the remaining species.
It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, email exchange@nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests this week are Gary Reno, Statehouse reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. And Gary, busy week. I really appreciate you being here.
Great to be here, Laura.
Also with us, Josh Rogers, NHPR's senior political reporter. Josh, thank you for being here as well.
Happy to be here, Laura.
And also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website NH Political Capital. And Dean, good to see you as always.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, and with us now, gentlemen, for our first segment is NHPR's Emily Corwin. She's our Southern New Hampshire reporter. She covered the two stories that we're going to begin with today. And Emily, thank you for taking time out.
Sure thing.
Well, first thing, Emily, two Manchester police officers were shot early this morning. A search for an armed suspect has been underway on the city's west side. What's the latest, Emily?
That's right. So there was a press conference around 6:30 this morning. The police chief and mayor explained that a man they're describing as a white male with long hair and a trench coat apparently shot two officers at different places on the west side of the city. One is at Catholic Medical Center. The other officer is at Elliott Hospital. Both appear to be stable. There's a shelter in place on that side of the city. Schools on the west side are closed today. And the white male who is being sought is still at large. So things are ongoing.
So the police officers were injured but not killed.
That's what they're saying.
And shelter in place. Wow, that's got a pretty dramatic sound to it for the west side of the city.
I was driving around Manchester this morning, and it was not too crazy. There was not a lot of the city that was shut down. I think it's just a few streets.
Well, another story that you covered, Emily, also concerning police. Two state troopers, one from New Hampshire, one from Massachusetts, have been relieved of their duties. How come?
So there was a big police chase that took place Wednesday evening. It started in northern Massachusetts, and it continued for an hour up into New Hampshire, into Hudson, and then Nashua. In New Hampshire, the New Hampshire State Troopers and some local police joined in this high-speed police chase. The driver got to a dead-end street in Nashua, and helicopter news videos show him stepping out of his car. He gets onto his knees and his hands, and he kind of appears to put his even his head on the ground. And that's when a sort of gaggle of police officers surround him, and you can see at least two officers punching him at least eight, maybe nine times. And so that took place Wednesday evening. Thursday morning, the attorney general announced an investigation. Thursday afternoon, both Massachusetts State Police and New Hampshire State Police announced that one officer from each department was on leave, at least in New Hampshire, without pay. I'm not sure about Massachusetts. And today, Massachusetts has a hearing for their officers. You know, the details of his suspension or relief of duty situation.
Well, a couple more questions for you, Emily, on the details of this. But Dean Spiliotis, to you too. I mean, this has been a national conversation.
Yeah, it's a big conversation. It's a complex conversation. The advent of smartphones and digital technology has made, you know, filming of police stops, in addition to some court cases as well, you know, through the ability to film these. In the particular case of this episode we're talking about, the chase had been going on for some time. I mean, you know, maybe in the moment they didn't realize that there were these news helicopters hovering overhead. But there's been a big conversation around the country with some shootings, with whether or not to have police wear body cams. There are privacy issues and cost issues associated with that. Again, these court cases about whether or not it's legal to film a police stop. So it's just been a big conversation around the country. And again, it's the technology that has made us aware of a lot of this that I think is spurring a lot of the movement on it. And this is just one more example that I think will feed into the larger conversation.
Well, it's interesting. In this case, it was old-fashioned, you know, news helicopter footage. But you're right,
Dean. But there also were some, I think there were some other filming on the ground as well. There were sort of multiple angles. You can see this particular episode from several different angles.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay, Gary, you want to jump in?
You know, this brings up the whole issue with the body cameras, too, which has been we've been debating back and forth. And yesterday it wasn't clear whether the police officer had a body camera or not. It did not appear to look like he did. But as we know, they had a pilot program, I think it was last year, but never got off the ground. Now they're outside trying to buy more dash cams as opposed to body cameras. The other issue that kind of is interesting is this whole issue of an independent investigation. Because the AG's office is always very tied to the police and prosecutors and all that. And I think we're going to hear some, probably next session, we're going to see some bills to establish an independent investigator's office or something like that.
Oh, that's really interesting, Gary. I'm glad you raised that point because you're right. Often the AG's office conducts these investigations and then people on the other side say, well, no, the AG's office isn't really independent enough
from
law enforcement.
We've had a number of cases of the use of force that the AG's office has investigated, and there are very few of them that come down on the side of the person. Most of them come down on the side of the police.
Josh?
Well, I mean, certainly, I mean, Gary's right that there was a, you know, a couple of years ago, there was a spate of police shootings of people, and, you know, in every one, the ruling by the AG was that the force was justified. And, you know, what's interesting in this case, one thing is that the footage, you know, you can see it from several angles. It's fairly clear. Emily described it well. The man got out of the truck. He put his head down. His hands were down. And,
so he looks like he's submitting.
I mean, we don't have any audio, so we don't know what he might have been saying. Mm-hmm. But you know, there's clearly a man with green striped trousers, you know, punching him several times. And Colonel Quinn, the commander of the state police, said that yesterday was pretty unequivocal. He said unnecessary and unjustified use of force won't be tolerated, and he called the video disturbing. So we'll see where it goes.
Yeah. Emily, in the video, as everybody's been saying, there's repeated punchings to this man, and he is surrounded. But give us the background to the incident. I mean, the arrest came after a long two-state high-speed chase on the highway. I mean, very dangerous. Someone could have easily been killed, some person, you know, commuting home from work.
Sure, and that's a whole other issue for another day probably is, you know, like whether these high-speed chases are a good idea. But the details of this individual's case is he's apparently a white man. He looks like a white guy. He's from Worcester. He was wanted in Massachusetts for an array of things, including larceny, assault, something to do with a dangerous weapon. And so I believe what happened is an officer, a local officer, tried to pull him over because he had these warrants out, and he took off. And so that was the beginning.
I see.
And
when he had apparently already escaped from them like a day or two earlier. This was their second encounter with him trying to bring him in.
Okay. So they've been trying to track this
yes.
guy down, and
only
there he
away,
is.
Right.
And so the officer says, oh, there he is. I'm going to go get him. And the guy takes off. And, yeah.
And then yesterday he waived his right to an extradition hearing, which means that if he's not already in Massachusetts, he will be very soon. So his time in New Hampshire is very limited.
Okay. Well, a couple Facebook comments actually on this. Paul says, so how much money will this cost the state when he sues? I'm assuming Paul is talking about he, the suspect. Paul says it should come out of the police budget, not our tax dollars. Terry says the beating turned what could have been a righteous arrest into an embarrassment for law enforcement. The officers involved in the beating need anger management training before they go back out. Very unprofessional. So that's just a sampling of a couple of our Facebook comments from our listeners. You can join us, too. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook, like Terry and Paul did. Or, again, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Well, guys, I did want to turn to a number of bills and other activities around the state concerning the opioid crisis. And Gary Reno, to you first, please. This has been a big priority for the legislature this year, and we've talked about it a lot. Where are we right now in terms of all the legislative action on this?
Well, to take a step back, I mean, we were supposed to have very quick action on a lot of this stuff in beginning of the session, and here we are on the last day of the session that we're finally passing some of these key bills. So it's kind of gotten bogged down in the legislative process. But the House did approve the last four bills that were out there, which are mostly the money bills. They'd provide about $9 to $10 million in additional money for various programs, from treatment to grants for police departments for interdiction, like the Granite Hammer program and things like that. They all passed. They all were different than the Senate version, so we're going to have a committee of conference on a lot of these bills. So it's still not over yet. We still got a long way to go, but it all passed in the House this Wednesday.
The House, politically, the House was seen as potentially the bigger hurdle in terms of getting this. And in terms of the substance, I mean, as Gary says, we're not done. So we'll see where these end up. But certainly the passage of money to facilitate drug courts in every county is a big deal. And some of the supportive housing money and, you know, a little money to beef up the prescription drug monitoring program. And, you know, we'll see what we end up with. But there's certainly a desire, seemingly, to get this done. And this is something that the governor has been pressuring the legislature on.
Yeah, it's funny. I recall discussing here at the roundtable back in January about
right.
how there was all this pressure to act quickly. And we all kind of knew even then that the money bills were going to take a little while. You know, we have this $10 million that's being divided up among these four or five items. And we're now basically at the end of the session. So it essentially took the whole session to get this done.
Well, and Gary, and maybe you too, Josh, you know, the folks who've been deeply involved in this mm-hmm. issue, you know, those involved in substance abuse treatment, really kind of leading the charge on this issue. How satisfying has this legislative response been, again, for the people who really care most about this?
Well, I mean, what they want is they want these bills passed, ultimately. But I'm sure, I mean, and you talk to some of these people, they kind of shake their heads and say, well, this should have been done long ago. I mean, it's not that much controversy here. I mean, most of the controversy why these bills were held up was how they're going to pay for them. I mean, we have an $80 million surplus, but none of the surplus is actually being used for any of these bills. I mean, we're using money that, quote-unquote, lapses, that isn't spent by other agencies. So that's where most of this money is coming from. So that was the big holdup. And I think most people are satisfied, but if this had happened 2 months ago, we'd be 2 months further down the road. And I think that's what is bothering some people.
Well, and Dean, what stood out for you from this whole process? I mean, you're absolutely right. Back in January, you know, this was the charge. Yeah.
Well, it's always the case that the devil's in the details. I mean, we had the special session last fall. This is an issue we've been talking about now for the better part of a year. We've seen the data on overdose deaths spiking for some time now. We talked last week about similarly discouraging numbers the first 4 months of this year. So, you know, the issue has been all along the cost. You know, who's going to pay for it? Where's the money going to come from? And, you know, it's good for everybody to sort of agree that there's a crisis. But as I mentioned, it has taken us, you know, 4 or 5 months to actually get it done. You know, in the end, I suppose it's a good thing if this is what people want to do. But it was not unsurprising to see that the actual and we're still not completely done working out the details about how to spend this money for drug courts and recovery housing, et cetera.
Again, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup today in the Exchange. And let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. We're talking about some of the big headlines around New Hampshire of the week. And we'd love your questions, comments, and thoughts at 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, let's go to Michelle. She's calling in from Concord. Hi, Michelle. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes. Well, I wanted to comment on the recent police brutality, which is unfortunate to have something like that happen in the great state of New Hampshire, where we take a lot of pride in our law enforcement. And, you know, I said I expect to see this kind of thing on the news, coming out of the Middle East, this type of barbarous, action. And I think it does. The average person looking at the footage can see it's an obvious wrong and way overuse. And it's just the idea of suggesting that, we'll need to look into it to see if proper use was used. That statement alone just it's just not right. That's not the immediate statement that should be made. It should say he was obviously in the wrong.
And, well, Michelle,
we don't want our children who, if they break the law, have to worry about our 20-year-olds being beaten up by the cops.
Michelle, thank you for calling in. It's a big story for sure, and a lot of people have watched that video multiple times. So I appreciate you calling in. Let's take another one, if we could. Melissa in Effingham. Hi, Melissa. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to speak to a point that was made earlier about whether or not the Attorney General's office investigating these things is as objective as it could be, and wondering what alternatives we might have for a truly independent investigation.
Well, Melissa, thank you for the comment. And Gary, you had mentioned that before, so go ahead.
We really don't have any alternatives right now. It's been the standard for a long time that the Attorney General's office would be investigating these issues with police brutality or a police officer fires a weapon and shoots someone. It's always been handled by the Attorney General's office. There really isn't anyone else.
Yeah. All right. Well, Melissa, it's a good question. And again, it's something that I think that people are looking at.
I mean, there's been certainly noise at the State House off and on about, would you create like an inspector general sort of thing? Or, could you have some sort of commission that would be, separate and apart from the Attorney General's office to review not only this, but the doings of state agencies. I mean, that's always been an issue when there's an issue involving, something at an agency and you have, the Attorney General's looking into it or, the governor's office. That was an issue in the past when you had the Attorney General's office reviewing, conduct of, someone working for a governor. And, is there the independence or at least the perception, if not in fact, that people, and I think the appetite may be increasing for that, but it's going to boil down to money and the will of the legislature and that.
Go ahead, Emily.
Yeah, it's also a particular issue that arises when you're dealing with law enforcement and you have an adversarial system where we're very used to having the defendant and the victim, and the police are usually, more or less, they're prosecuting on behalf of the victim. And in, even in reporting this, it was sort of funny. It was like, well, this guy, he's a defendant. He's also potentially a victim. And when you have this adversarial system that's like A versus B, it just really throws it on its head to have the police being, you know, in the position of possibly being the defendants, right? So I think that's a peculiar aspect to police brutality questions.
Well, Emily, thank you very much for helping us out. We know you had a early, busy morning. So thank you for being here.
Sure. Thank you.
That's NHPR's Emily Corwin, our Southern New Hampshire reporter. More of our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup in just a minute. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. Join us as we cover some of the top headlines of the week. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests on the roundup this week are Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, Josh Rogers, NHPR's senior political reporter, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And gentlemen, a couple more questions on some of the activities surrounding opioid addiction, what's often called the opioid crisis here in New Hampshire. Gary Reno updated us on some of the legislation. Dean Spiliotis, for some reason, U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack was in the state talking about this. A couple people around the newsroom said, why is the Agriculture Secretary talking about opioid abuse?
Fair question. There was this so-called drug summit in Manchester in which I think something like 800 people showed up. It was a governor's summit on substance abuse. He was one of the featured speakers. Some people may remember Tom Vilsack. He was a two-term governor of Iowa, flirted with a presidential run in 2004. I remember spending a lot of time with him in 2004 as he was exploring a presidential bid, ended up not running. He's been President Obama's Secretary of Agriculture for a long time. And Obama made him the head of a task force to look into this. So he's someone who's sort of looking at this issue from a federal level. And obviously, as we've seen with our senators, Shaheen and Ayotte, there's been some interest in bringing federal dollars up here to help deal with this. So he's in the mix because of his position at the head of this task force. So he was up at the summit giving a talk.
Well, and he talked to Rick Ganley, our Morning Edition host. To that point you just made, Dean, about how to best leverage federal, state, and local efforts. Let's hear.
And I think there needs to be a creative utilization of federal, state, and local resources. During the course of the drug court discussions yesterday, I realized that a program we have at USDA that provides housing loans might be creatively used to create opportunities to build the transition housing that's required for folks who are in drug court.
Again, that's U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack talking about rural opioid abuse. It kind of gives you a sense, Gary, of how much is needed along the continuum to combat this issue. It isn't just throw somebody in treatment and then say thank you very much.
Oh, no. I mean, obviously it's kind of a lifelong struggle for a lot of people, but it certainly is a several years struggle in initial stages. And, I mean, you need to have those services in place. And the treatment is one thing. And, a lot of people just think treatment, they think well, residential treatment, but I mean, most people don't need residential treatment. Most people can have outpatient treatment. But those services beyond that, once you're out of treatment and you're in recovery, those can last a long time. And you need to have all that sort of wraparound so that people have the services they need so they can continue to get over their addiction.
Well, and as you said, Gary, this is the last week for the House and Senate to vote on bills. Right. Mm-hmm. After this, they have to kind of come together and find agreement. So there was a lot that happened at the State House this week. And let's talk about some of that. And Josh, to you first, a familiar chestnut came up in the House, marijuana decriminalization. The House has tried to do this a number of times. What happened this week?
Well, the House passed a version of a decriminalization bill, which would allow a violation level offense for a first offense. It would be a $300 fine, and it passed with relative ease. I think it's the seventh time the House has passed decriminalization, and it's something that members of both parties in the House have demonstrated that they're quite comfortable with. Good luck in the Senate. It's been a tougher road there. They've never passed decriminalization, although this year they did pass a bill, which is the underlying bill that the House tacked this onto, a measure that aim to rejigger the classification of personal marijuana. If you got busted with personal use marijuana, essentially you could be assigned, it would be assigned a non-specific misdemeanor, which backers of the bill would allow judges leeway. Some would say they already have that leeway, but would explicitly allow them the leeway to treat it as a violation level offense. And one thing that is sort of interesting about this is that this approach was actually supported by the New Hampshire Association of Police Chiefs, who have been essentially for years led the charge against slackening marijuana laws in any way. And they were on board with this, but people were concerned that, you know, this could potentially lead to unequal treatment, that, you know, those better situated in society might be given more slack in the courts than those less so, which
sure.
is, you know, obviously.
So people who know how to
yeah.
work with the legal system versus people who don't. Is this like a compromise decriminalization, Gary?
This is a bill that actually was it's almost exactly the same as what was agreed to last year between the House and the Senate and ostensibly the governor's office. But the whole thing fell apart at the very end. So
how come?
I'm not sure exactly why, but I think the few people wanted a little more than they were willing to – others were willing to give at the very end.
And, well, in the backdrop of the opioid issue is something that's made this a tougher go politically because
yeah,
the notion that you know, some people would say that it's illogical to – equate marijuana policy with, you know, fighting opioid abuse, but that just the optics of slackening something on the marijuana front made some people uncomfortable
right.
politically.
And people who do oppose these kinds of decriminalization, they often argue that it's a gateway drug, that marijuana is a gateway. So if you believe that marijuana is a gateway drug, you're going to oppose these because that's how you link it to these other issues with, you know, heroin and opioids, et cetera. And, you know, it seems like every year they try with a smaller and smaller amount. I think next session it's going to be, you know, an eighth of an ounce and then a 16th of an ounce. Be one down to one joint eventually. Yeah, they keep trying.
Well, and to Josh's point about the optics of this, Dean,
sure.
I have heard people say, you know, in the midst of an opioid crisis,
right.
what are we doing easing up on other drugs?
But New Hampshire does remain the only New England state where there is
right.
no decriminalization. And, you know, it's a state where I remember asking Governor Hassan, who's been, you know, sort of leery on appearing soft on this. You know, we're a state when there's a huge snowstorm, we don't tell people to, you know, stay off the roads like they do in Massachusetts. They say, you know, use your discretion, you know, live free or die and all that. And, you know, historically, in some ways, it's been Democrats that have been at least Democratic governors who have been more leery of moving on this than have Republican lawmakers who have tended, you know, there's a law and order strain, but there's also those who have taken a more sort of libertarian approach to this. And so we'll see where this goes. I mean, what do you think is going to happen, Gary?
I don't think it's going anywhere this year.
Really?
No. I mean, it's just said, I mean, it's the atmosphere right now. We're in the middle of a drug crisis. It's pretty easy to say no to this.
Even though, as you know, as Josh said, there seems to be some agreement around this approach towards, you know, making your first offense less of a harsh punishment.
Oh, and I mean, I think there is that aspect to it, which I think everybody wants to achieve. Even the governor has said.
Okay, so that may go through. Just the strict decriminalization
like that
will
may
not go
pass,
through.
But this bill, in the way it is now, I don't think it's going to go. It isn't going to go through the Senate right now.
Okay. Again, the number for you to join our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Give us your questions, comments, and thoughts as we cover some of the top headlines of the week at 1-800-892-6477. Another issue that has come up a lot in recent years, and Josh, I'll turn to you first again, concealed carry and whether a special permit is needed to carry a gun in a concealed fashion. And I think NHPR had a clip this week of a supporter of getting rid of these special permits saying this just allows someone who can already legally carry a gun to put his coat on. So
well,
can you just fill
I
us
mean,
in there?
That has been an argument that kind of trope has been used by several lawmakers that, you know, I get in my truck and I drive up to the North Country and it may be raining out, so I put on my windbreaker and I've got my gun and why shouldn't I be able to do that? And that's, you know, sort of a new way of pitching this argument. I mean, certainly, you know, people who are supportive of the full constitutional right, they call it constitutional carry, believe that this is something that, ought to be done. As it tends to be, there are not many Democrats who support this. I don't know how many times has it passed at this point. Several,
and
the governor is going to veto it. I mean, she
will.
Yes, and they're not going to have the votes to override. And I think there are actually two bills that are out there that would achieve.
There was one attempt to have it so that if you qualify for a license, then the local community official in charge has to issue you a concealed carry permit. The concern is that it's too arbitrary right now, that either the local police chief or whoever's in charge in your town gets to decide. So there was
how it works.
And there was an initial move to say, okay, if you're licensed to carry openly, then the police chief has to issue you a second concealed carry license. Now I think this is a little bit different, right? This is just to do away with it, I believe.
Well, there are two. One does that, and the other one basically says you don't need a permit. So
to carry concealed at all. Yeah. So what's the status of these bills now,
Gary? Both have been passed by the House and the Senate. They're different, though, so they're going to have a committee of conference on them.
Okay. And then your expectation, Josh, is that Governor Hassan will
veto. She said she will.
She has said she will.
Yeah. And she has before, and she will again.
Well, we got some Facebook commentary on this as well. As you said, Hassan has vetoed these before. Ron says, I'm pro-gun 100% and agree that Hassan did the right thing. Here's a comment from Sunshine again on Facebook. She says, I feel we need to carry for protection. Look at today. Two officers were shot and the suspect is armed and dangerous. I would feel better if I had a gun to protect my children and myself. So that's, again, some commentary from our listeners on the concealed carry issue. And we'll see what happens in the committee of conference. And then it looks like you guys are saying the governor will veto this. I also wanted to ask all of you about the issue of real ID. That came up again this week as well. And Dean, just remind us, what is real ID?
Well, there's a federal program that's being implemented to basically give you more secure ID. It keeps more information about you essentially on file through your state driver's licenses. And the issue is that most – I think there are only three or four states who have sort of held out against this. Most states have adopted these new federal IDs as kind of the standard for driver's licenses, the technology that goes into them, the kinds of information required.
This was a post-9/11.
Yeah, post-9/11. Yeah. Right.
This is that old.
Right. So now, starting January 2nd, the state, New Hampshire, will make these enhanced IDs available if you want them, but you won't be required. And your regular license will still be good, I think, until 2020. So you have some time to decide, or roughly 5 years. You have some time to decide. But basically what the compromise was, okay, this is going ahead at the federal level. Let's make it at least optional for people who might want it, but we're not going to require it.
Well, and if you don't have it, I mean, at some point you're going to be barred entrance to federal buildings.
Right.
You're not going to be able to get on an airplane unless you have a passport. And so, for years, there have been deadlines, and then there are new rounds of waivers that have been granted. And, this seems like something that is a, what we talked about is a New Hampshire-style compromise that everyone loves to talk about.
I mean, what's interesting about this is it's a, quote, an opt-in, not an opt-out. No. So you have to request it. It's not going to be automatically federal compliant ID. If you just want to renew your license, that's not going to be compliant with the federal standards. You're going to have to ask for the specific ID to
you're going to have to volunteer
specifically,
right.
Specifically ask to have a federally compliant ID.
So people who work at the DMV's office, Gary, you're going to have to spend some time explaining to folks what this means.
Well,
those lines could get even longer.
They will be longer.
At least initially.
There's also a third ID that's part of this, which is one that allows you to go basically in North America, you can cross borders with it. It's a real time.
Because we're close to Canada.
Canada, if you're going between Canada and the United States or Mexico and the United States or the Caribbean and whatever, because it lets you look at real time at your information that's in the database. So that if you're doing a lot of traveling within the continental North America, then you can get this ID. That's going to cost you $30
more.
Yeah,
this is like a premier, like an extra special premium.
Yeah,
ID.
So it's not quite a real ID?
It's more, but sort of an alternative to a passport that will allow you to travel in North America.
Wow.
So it's sort of like real ID, premium, and then passport.
So
you have a number of choices there.
So, Dean, as Josh mentioned, this stems from 9/11 and concerns that the hijackers got fake driver's licenses and so forth. But why did this issue hang around for so long? I mean, not just in this state, but in other states. It's been 15 years.
Yeah, here in New Hampshire, there's a tradition of privacy rights. It's kind of a libertarian streak to our culture. Again, Josh mentioned earlier, live free or die. You know, the idea that this was kind of a personal an infringement in terms of what kinds of information you want the federal government to have immediate access to, whether it's your social security number or some other pieces of information about you. So it's just been kind of part of the sort of political culture in our state for a long time. I don't recall the other states off the top of my head, but it's only three or four states that have resisted this, and we've been one of them.
Well, and speaking of privacy, people's concerns about surveillance and so forth, Gary, perfect segue to talk about the drone regulations that the legislature looked at this week. Now, these have been a long time in the making as well, Gary, although probably not 15 years.
No.
What are the main provisions and why did it take so long?
Yeah, this has been a couple of years in the making, and it's trying to get everybody together on the same page as to what you want to do. And I mean, basically, this is a whole lot less than what I think people envisioned when they started out by thinking that they're going to regulate drones. It's been driven by Neil Kirk, who is the legislature's chief privacy advocate.
Not a fan of Real ID. He led the charge against that back then.
And when he started out, it was very strict and you couldn't fly within 250 feet of a home and all this other thing. Well, now it's largely says if you're flying over somebody's private property, you have to have permission. If you're below 250 feet, basically forbids government from using it without these strict guidelines. Law enforcement can't collect evidence without a warrant, all this sort of stuff.
You can use it for reporting, though.
But you can use it for reporting.
Thank goodness.
It's a carve-out for reporting. But it's a lot less than what you would think. I mean, part of the problem is that the federal government regulates most of this. And when you start passing these things on a state level, you start getting into questions of whether who's going to have the federal law will supersede this.
Well, that's the question. And there's been concerns that federal law, how does that stack up with state law? Obviously, you fly your drone over the Massachusetts border or whatever. What happens there? I mean, how are they going to, Dean, how are they going to sort this out? Or Josh, you want to jump in?
Well, I do think the enforceability of this will be interesting to see how that happens. I mean, I'm assuming if you stay away from flying your drone near an airport or prison and, keep it roughly at altitude, you'll probably be fine. But it'll be interesting to see once this happens. So
there have been episodes of people literally shooting at drones that fly over their property to get to take them down.
Well, sure. I mean, because who knows what that drone is.
Exactly.
Here's a quote from a USA Today story. Local laws are on a collision course with the Federal Aviation Administration, which contends it controls the airspace and wants to set a single national policy for drones instead of a patchwork of local laws. So, Gary, does this satisfy the FAA?
No. A lot of it doesn't, which is a nice segue, though, into the Uber discussion.
Let's talk about that. Uber, the ride-sharing service. Lawmakers also approved regulations for Uber this week. I mean, again, Gary, a huge week at the State House.
Well, the Uber regulation basically is what's being used in a lot of other states. It's pretty loose. They have to register. They have to have insurance. They have to do background checks. But a lot of this other stuff that the cities like Manchester and Portsmouth were proposing in their regulations, it's not there. And it's largely what Uber wanted with a few exceptions.
Such as you can have insurance that applies to you only when you're on the clock, essentially, for Uber. That was something, the whole question of how these people would be insured. And there was testimony before the committee of somebody who was an early Uber driver who was trying to comply with, I think it was Portsmouth's requirement for, hack bureau insurance for the, taxi and limousine. So that was something that needed to be resolved. And the background checks is, but we'll see.
Right. Well, a couple more State House bills to catch up on, guys, including one concerning what's called conversion therapy. So we'll talk about that after a break. Also, two more state senators said this week that they will not run for re-election, leaving a couple open seats there in the state Senate. We'll wrap that up in just a minute. This is The Exchange on NHPR. It's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Today in The Exchange, I'm Laura Kanoy. You can join us as we catch up on some of the top Granite State headlines. of the Week, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. This week, our guests are Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, Josh Rogers, NHPR's senior political reporter, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, one or two more bills that I did want to get the latest from you on. And then I do want to talk about the two state senators who added their names to the list of people who will not run for re-election next year. But Josh, let's start with you. This week, the legislature looked at something called conversion therapy. Now, there's a lot to talk about here, but just remind us what conversion therapy is.
Well, first of all, it wasn't simply this week. I mean, this debate in both House and Senate took a lot longer
Absolutely.
Than a lot of people would have thought. But, you know, in short, conversion therapy is therapy that aims to convert somebody's sexual orientation or gender identity. And the legislature is seeking to ban licensed therapists for offering conversion therapy to minors, to people under 18.
It concerns children. Adults can seek whatever therapy they want.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what happened this week? And you're right. They have been talking about this all year.
Well, ultimately, and I will confess off the top that this happened after I was tuned out of goings on at the State House last night. They tabled the bill, and seemingly it was because they were at a real impasse that wasn't going to be bridged. And there were questions of should there be carve-outs in the prohibition to deal with – to address concerns about parental rights and religious liberties. And there was a real divide, mainly partisan, over this, where Democrats really wanted a straight-up ban and, you know, consumer protection language in. And some Republican senators wanted amendments that would make them more comfortable that people would be able to exercise their religious and parental rights as they understood them. And so, you know, there was a long back and forth. This was debated over 2 weeks. There were a number of votes, a number of amendments. You know, it was laid on the table and then, you know, taken off the table. And I don't know, what time did it pass last night? Like 9 or 10 o'clock?
Yeah, close to 10
yeah.
O'clock.
Wow, late night. Yeah, and we did a whole program on this. So I'm familiar with these sort of bigger, broader picture questions of parental rights, religious liberties, and so forth. Gary, I'd love your thoughts. And then I have a question for you too, Dean.
Well, I left the State House at 8 o'clock last night, and when I checked around, and they still hadn't gotten very far in the negotiations, so I figured I was safe leaving. But this goes to prove you're never safe leaving these people.
Right.
I guess the real key point here was it penalizes therapists who advertise or engage in, which was not in the proposal earlier in the day. And that once that had the that in the bill, I guess, then it was more acceptable to the Democrats. And I guess it was 16-8 the vote. So it was a pretty good vote for the bill.
Yeah. Well, and Dean, when we talked about it, we heard from ministers who maybe weren't licensed psychotherapists, but said, if a young person comes to me and says I'm confused about my sexual identity, you know, will this mean I can't make a suggestion to them that fits with my religious outlook?
Yeah, it's an issue that's important to people who are focused on the ability of a religious advisor to provide some sort of, you know, quote, therapy. I think, you know, we're talking about licensed practitioners, but there certainly are these kind of gray areas that can be problematic. I mean, this is a conversation that's been going on around the country for several years now, hearing about states moving against conversion therapy. A lot of testimony from people who went through it and kind of the impact it had and, you know, whether or not it really works. So it was interesting to see the state legislature here finally move on it.
Well, and right now I believe there are 4 states who have similar prohibitions on the books: Illinois, California, Oregon, and New Jersey. I believe it's also banned in D.C. I think there are bills pending in other state houses. But, you know, this was interesting because in both House and Senate, the final vote on the bill was more lopsided than, you know, you would have suspected based on the debate. And in both chambers, in the House, I believe they, you know, conservatives tried to table this and, you know, failed relatively narrowly, even though it had been, I mean, I thought it came out of committee in the House unanimously.
Yeah.
And so You know, once on the floor, the debate around this issue, you know, became, you know, pretty animated and pretty heated at times in both chambers. And, you know, when yesterday afternoon, when it looked like this was not going to come off the table, you know, Senate Majority Leader Jeb Bradley, who was looked like he was trying to, you know, get some sort of middle ground, he said, you know, the fact that New Hampshire allows conversion therapy, like, we're going to put a black mark on it by passing this ban, but we need to have this middle ground. And, you know, most of the Senate wasn't buying that, but I guess something happened after we all left. That,
well,
that the and
probably had dinner and softened up a little bit.
One more question about the state Senate, and then I did want to turn briefly to the U.S. Senate race here in New Hampshire. Dean Spiliotis, this week two more state senators said they won't run for re-election, Republican David Booten and Democrat Molly Kelly. Why is this significant, Dean?
Well, you know, obviously in New Hampshire, Senate seats are up every 2 years. You know, this is roughly number five and number six of a half dozen seats that are now available for a variety of reasons. I think the party breakdown is there are four Republicans who are not running for re-election and two Democrats. We know in presidential years, the Democratic turnout tends to be a little bit higher. So there's hope among Democrats that they may be able to tip the balance a little bit in the state Senate. So, you know, I don't think this is sort of out of the ordinary, but it's certainly an opportunity for Democrats. And you know, there's a variety of different reasons for people leaving. You know, Russell Prescott's running for executive counsel. Gene Forrester is running for governor. Jerry Little's going to be the banking commissioner. And then a few others are retiring as well. So there were reasons for people moving on. Both Kelly and Booten have been sort of long-serving state legislators. So
what's interesting is that three of these four Republican seats are kind of toss-ups, particularly in a presidential year.
The retirements matter, but also where they're happening matters.
And the presidential year, obviously.
The presidential year is particularly brings out the Democrats a lot more. I mean, Forrester's seat in the second district is a kind of a toss-up. The same with the Little seat in District 8 and also Booten's seat, which is part of Manchester and Hooksett, Bow, and Dunbarton, I believe. But two of them, the two Democratic seats are pretty safe Democratic seats, and Prescott's seat down in 23 is a pretty safe Republican seat.
I mean, certainly David Pierce is retiring. I mean, he's leaving the Senate of the Upper Valley, and that's, you know, the Republicans simply not going to win that seat in all but the rarest circumstances. And, you know, while Republicans have held the seat in Keene, that's pretty safe, as Gary says. And so it'll be interesting to see. I mean, this certainly the Booten seat is something that Democrats believe is winnable.
And I think, too, there'll be more. We haven't seen the end of this.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There'll be a couple more people that will announce that they're leaving.
Okay, so with only 24 seats, Gary, you know, when someone leaves, it's a big deal.
Big turnover this year.
Okay, well, again, the number for you to join the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And I did want to turn, gentlemen, to the U.S. Senate race now. And I know you talked about this a fair bit last week, Dean Spiliotis, but I'll turn to you first. Things keep happening on the campaign trail. What did you hear this week in terms of how the presidential race is trickling down to New Hampshire's U.S. Senate race?
Well, there's a lot of discussion about Donald Trump's moves to unite the Republican Party. He had these meetings in Washington with Speaker Paul Ryan and a number of other members of Congress. You know, up here, the focus has really been on kind of watching Kelly Ayotte figure out how to deal with this. And she had that, you know, famous statement about about supporting Trump, but not endorsing him. And in fact, you know, Stephen Colbert and others have kind of mocked it a little bit. So it's gotten national attention as kind of she I think unintentionally has become sort of the poster member of Congress for people who are kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. And a lot of the issue, I think, for her will be, you know, how does Trump do here in the state? He won the Republican primary here with about 35% of the vote. I've seen some polling data more recently that shows there is some buyer's remorse. On the other hand, he may get a bit of a bump if he's able to kind of unify the party and has a good convention. So she's in a tough spot. So a lot of the discussion in terms of the connection between here and the national race has been really sort of watching her kind of navigate this. And, you know, the Democratic side, they've certainly been piling on. And, you know, Maggie Hassan recently did a politics and eggs discussion where she talked a lot about her, you know, her usual themes of kind of bipartisanship and success with the budget et cetera. So it feels like the race is heating up. Also, some outside money coming in with advertising as well.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Governor Hassan sort of talking about we do things differently here in New Hampshire, and Kelly Ayotte trying to seek that middle ground. We have sound of both of these candidates out on the trail this week talking about those themes, Dean. So let's hear.
Time and again in New Hampshire, we have shown that we can put our differences aside and get results for our people and our businesses. And it is long past time for Washington to take the same approach.
I'm going to vote for our Republican nominee, but I don't intend to endorse anyone in this race. I'm running for re-election, and I'm really focusing on serving the people of New Hampshire and the work that I do for them.
Again, that was Governor Maggie Hassan, Democrat running for U.S. Senate, and the incumbent Republican U.S. Senator Kelly Ayotte. And Josh Rogers, I'd love your thoughts, too, on some of the themes that we heard from these candidates this week.
Well, for now, it's clear that Kelly Ayotte really wants to make this race about New Hampshire as much as she can, rather than allow it to be seen as sort of a national referendum on Donald Trump. And, you know, we'll see. Maybe that would be fine at the end of the day. I mean, we're a long ways from the general election. You know, you look at the focus is on very much on New Hampshire, and I'm representing you. And, you know, her office has been going after, or her campaign has been going after Governor Hassan a bit for her, you know, rather prolific out-of-state fundraising schedule, at least last month, where she was gone a good deal. And so that's something that I expect to hear more of. I mean, the Ayotte, when there's been money spent against Ayotte, and there has been a bunch of money spent, it's always they say, oh, these are more attacks from Governor Hassan's Washington allies, as if you know, Governor Hassan, I mean, sort of running against Washington from Washington to some degree. But, you know, no one likes Washington. So we'll see.
That's
how this
one
works
message
out,
that we're getting from this.
And a lot of this money is a Senate Majority PAC, which is Harry Reid's PAC in the U.S. Senate.
Do you want to jump into, Gary?
Yeah, what I thought was interesting this week is, you know, you can strategize all you want and have game plans all you want, but they can get thrown off very quickly. And that's what we saw with the Nashua incident with the police. And watching Maggie Hassan trying to carefully negotiate this whole issue was very interesting to watch this week. I mean, she does not want to offend the state police in any way. And so she was talking about how she didn't want to rush to judgment. I mean, it was a very concerning issue. She was all behind the criminal investigation, but we shouldn't be rushing to judgment. So, I mean, she's obviously not wanting to cede that at all to Kelly Ayotte, the former attorney general.
Yeah, so the issue of law enforcement and Governor Hassan in general, Gary, has sided with law enforcement on,
she has,
you know,
very
some
much
of these
sided
issues.
With law, I mean, decriminalization, I mean, down the line, basically.
Guns and so forth.
I mean, certainly, like, you know, Kelly Ayotte comes from a law enforcement background as a prosecutor, and you know, that scene, you know, she's very popular among police. And you know, for Democrats, that's particularly, like, sort of law and order tends to play better with Republicans than Democrats. And I agree with Gary that Governor Hassan, I mean, as did Governor Lynch, I mean, it was a very concerted effort to, you know, keep good relationships with the state troopers.
Well, and here's an email from Kevin, who would probably appreciate that language that Governor Hassan used, you know, not rushing to judgment, Gary. Kevin in Conway says, I've been waiting and hoping to hear someone else call in support of our officers. These guys are only humans as well. They put on a gun and a badge every day to go look for trouble to keep the rest of us safe. They have adrenaline like the rest of us. This guy put a lot of people in harm's way, and you don't know his background. With assault charges. Now these guys, meaning the troopers, lose their livelihood and benefits and their lifestyle because of a criminal. Thanks, says Kevin. Kevin, thank you for that email. And then a couple Facebook comments about Kelly Ayotte and her position on Donald Trump. Christopher says, in my book, supporting someone or something is the same as endorsement. You can't have it both ways. Ayotte, that's from Christopher. Dale says she doesn't agree or even like Trump, and for a number of reasons, but the only way the Republican Party can exist is to follow his lead. If anyone endorses him, they will have to live with it and be reminded for the rest of their lives that they have endorsed. In any event, their careers may be over if they give him a nod of approval. Would Kelly Ayotte's career be
over Josh Rogers, that, you know, she's trying to stand on her own 2 feet and say, I'm here for New Hampshire and don't mind about that presidential race?
Well, I you know, that's not for me to say, but I would tend to doubt that. I mean, you know, but it, you know, she is in a tough spot. And you look at in any senator in a Republican for reelection in a swing state facing a competitive race. You know, a lot of them are in this position, and, you know, her language may have been a little too trying to straddle a bit much. And, you know, it for me, it actually like sort of called to mind during her first race when the FRM Ponzi scheme was up and this was an issue that was being raised. Did the attorney general handle it? And she was called to testify before a committee. And the talking point she went in with was, you know, I'm all for the principle that the buck stops at my desk, but it has to reach my desk for it to stop with me. And it was sort of a similar kind of thing where it was an attempt to get something across that, you know, the layperson might view as almost like sort of oxymoronic or like contradictory. And so this isn't the first time she's come out with this sort of statement in a potentially fraught political. This is, you know, Trump is potentially a bigger issue in this political cycle than, you know, FRM was in 2010 when she was running against Paul Hodes.
The drawback for her is that even though there are a number, as Josh mentioned, there are a number of senators around the country who are in a similar position in these key Senate swing state races, her particular kind of splitting hairs really became kind of the national model for people who were stuck in this position. I mean, it was just everywhere nationally on the late night shows. They always used her as kind of the example of how difficult this is. So that's just something she has to deal with.
Well, all of you, I always like to end the roundup by asking what you're going to be covering next week. And Gary Reyno, I'm guessing it's a big mop-up for you, right?
We'll be in the middle of the Committee of Conference, which is the time that we have to watch the bouncing balls and see if you can find out where the bouncing balls are. Yes.
And again, that's where the House and Senate put together their differences.
Negotiate their differences to try to come up with a compromise bill that they can put back before the Senate and House.
Okay, Josh, how about you? What are you working on next week?
Sort of the same. I mean, we'll see, like, you know, interesting things happen at this time of year. Or not interesting, but, you know, things happen.
Following some the same things, bouncing yeah. balls that Gary's going to be following. And Dean, how about you?
Firing up Pints in Politics at the Barley House here in Concord for the summer election season. Today at 12:45, interviewing Democratic gubernatorial candidate Colin Van Ostern. Tuesday at 11:30 a.m. at the Barley House, Governor Hassan for an interview.
Okay, 11:30, that's awfully early to have a beer, Dean.
Lunchtime. Well, yeah, with lunch. We'll have it with some food with it.
Thank you all very much for being here. I really appreciate it. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Mikesell and Jessica Hunt. Our volunteers, Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kinoy.